Welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Major Edward Horgan, Irish Army, retired. He looks at planes and ships at Shannon Airport and Dublin Port. He's a bit of a plane spotter, but he's looking at what those planes are being used for. Troop carriers, backwards and forwards, most of them, between the United States and the Middle East. Also, post-Brexit crises, economic and a potential Middle East war. Dave Bazanko interviews me about that. And also Olivia Ware and Vicky Brown from the charity Many Minds, which helps with mental health and drama. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
I'm Edward Horgan. I'm a former major in the Irish Defence Forces and served with the UN on several occasions on peacekeeping missions. I've been a peace activist, I suppose, for the last 20 years or so.
Can you tell us something about your military service? What really stands out for you in your own memory?
I suppose the United Nations peacekeeping would stand out most. I would have served in Cyprus on several occasions and also in the Middle East in 1973, just after the Yom Kippur War. So I suppose I would have seen war firsthand, basically. We were what we used to refer to as the pig in the middle on several occasions, in between the opposing forces, trying to create a buffer zone. I suppose I would have seen the futility of war as well as the suffering, not only for the civilians involved, but also many of the soldiers involved in war are just conscripts and they are also victims of war.
So can you give us a couple of examples, or maybe even just one example, of a specific incident that really taught you and put you, in, I suppose, on the track that you're on today?
I suppose my first incident, in fact, I was in Cyprus as a young second lieutenant, and as it happened on my 21st birthday, we happened to be in between the Greek Cypriots and the Turkish Cypriots, and in the middle of the night, they decided to start firing at each other, and one of the gunners decided to target me instead, and I was almost blown away by a heavy machine gun. Fortunately, he missed. But at that point, I decided that life is going to be short. I might as well both enjoy it and make the most of it. And I've been doing that in the meantime. And I suppose it also emphasized the need for creating peace instead of creating war.
So what are you up to these days then? And what part of Ireland are you in?
I live in Limerick, which is the nearest big town to Shannon Airport. And unfortunately, even though Ireland is a neutral country, our government has allowed the US military to use Shannon Airport basically as a forward airbase since the 9/11. And in particular, for the Afghan war and the Iraq war, and more recently, for the attacks on both Libya and Syria.
I'm afraid that most Brits, their geography and knowledge of the towns of Ireland is not very good. So can you just tell us where is Limerick and where is Shannon Airport?
It's in the midwest of Ireland, on the west coast, and Shannon Airport is literally about 15 miles from where I live. So I suppose I was one of the first to become aware that the airport was being used extensively. And in 2003, in fact, just after the beginning of the Iraq war, I actually took a High Court constitutional case against the US, against the Irish government. I lost part of the case, but I also won the issue in that the High Court judge found that Ireland was in breach of international laws and neutrality by claiming to be a neutral state, yet allowing troops on their way to war to pass in large numbers to Shannon Airport.
I mean, I was going to say, if, for example, NATO, you know, is Ireland in NATO? Because this, you know, it does seem very strange. I mean, we've got other countries, haven't we? like, for example, Sweden and Austria are not in NATO, and yet they do seem to be part of a military alliance. I wonder what is the point of not being in NATO if you're allowing, I mean, for example, I think we would be rather shocked if Russian troop-carrying planes started to land at Shannon and refuel and take off, heading, say, for example, for Ukraine.
Absolutely. In fact, there was a big hoo-ha about 2 years ago when a Russian military plane flew down the Atlantic about 200 miles from Ireland, and people were maintaining it a breach of, or it a threat and whatever. It was completely spurious, in fact. And the Irish media and Western media ignored completely the fact that the US military had at least two or three planes flying to Shannon Airport on a daily basis.
Okay, so as a retired military man and a veteran, how do you view Ireland's neutrality?
I think it's hugely important. Ireland is such a small country, we can never be a military power, and would be quite stupid for us to do so. In World War One, when we were still part of Britain, we lost almost 50,000 young Irishmen killed in the Somme and elsewhere. And if there was another major European war, we would just be cannon fodder as we were in World War One. We can do a lot more and have done a lot more for international peace and sustainable development.
So how was the first, because it all happened around about the same time, how was the First World War related to the Irish uprising, the declaration of the Free State and the eventual Republic?
It was significantly related because many people objected. There was an attempt to bring in conscription. And there was a strong objection to that. Yet, I think almost 250,000 Irish soldiers served with the British forces. And as I mentioned, we lost almost 50,000 dead. In the middle of the First World War, we had the 1916 Rising, which eventually led to independence in 1922. So it was quite significant. But ever since then, ever since our independence in 1922, Ireland has been a neutral state. We were neutral throughout the Second World War. And partly we are neutral because, first of all, we can afford to be, but also for historical reasons and because of our First World War experience. It would be completely foolish of Ireland to be anything other than neutral, although in recent times our government are trying very hard to get us in the back door to NATO, to Partnership for Peace, and also to try and now involve us with a European army. This people keep saying it's not an army.
Tell us about that then. Is it going to happen, this European army? Because both Macron, almost at the same time, Macron and Merkel have both said this is what they are going to institute now.
Absolutely. And as it happens, I spent 6 weeks in Russia early on this year with the OSCE observing the presidential elections there. I met many, many people at all levels, from the local village to high officials, who are very worried about being threatened by NATO, and in particular by Germany and France. And they will remind you on a regular basis, we had Napoleon back in the 1800s, and we had Hitler, and Hitler and Germany cost the Russian people something like 27 million dead. And every town you go to, they have monuments to the Great Patriotic War. They are very fearful, in fact, of being surrounded by NATO and of being attacked because of their natural resources.
Now, Edward, you're not the ordinary type of what one would consider nerdy plane spotter taking the numbers of the planes at Shannon. Tell me, how did you first decide to do that, and what have you seen over the years?
But at the time, I happened to be a mature student at the University of Limerick, and we had a peace society. And as soon as I realised the US military were going to, I got a bunch of my fellow students, and we started having little protests, and we went out with binoculars and cameras and took some photographs. And it developed from there. And now we do it a bit more sophisticated way. We use partly electronic means, but also the best way, in fact, very often is to go to the airport, take photographs, put them up on my Facebook page. We also have a website with our organization called Shannon Watch, and we post the photographs of the planes which at times can be quite embarrassing to the US, because we also target the CIA because they had used the airport for their torture and rendition program back in the 2001, 2, 3, and 4 in particular. And we were able to track CIA planes from the US into Europe that we used in actual renditions. And we publicised that. And just, I put one example of what we can achieve. We also succeeded in putting off some of this civilian troop carriers. Quite a few of the planes going through were actually civilian planes on charter to the US military. And by publicising what's going on, it helps to at least make the Irish public aware of what's going on, and also to maintain Irish neutrality. I believe that part of our success is that we are still a neutral country, more or less. At least we have prevented the government from bringing Ireland into NATO.
Well, it doesn't sound like you are neutral if you're allowing, you know, Shannon to be used by the US military in this way. It's almost like you have become now another unsinkable aircraft carrier for them.
Very much so, in fact, and that analogy is one we make. So we are trying to get that reversed, and we will take probably further legal cases against the Irish government, and we do put a lot of pressure on the Irish government. We have parliamentary questions being asked to friendly independent TDs almost on a daily basis. And in recent times, I was able to track one particular aircraft owned by a large civilian air cargo company called National Air. It came from the States, refueled the Shannon, went down to the Middle East, then went to Djibouti, to Camp Lemonnier in Djibouti, which is just across the Red Sea from Yemen. It was, in my view, quite clearly delivering military equipment, and that usually means bombs, to Camp Lemonnier, where the US carries out drone strikes and special forces strikes.
Now, I mean, I'm surprised that the American military allow these onto the internet. Whereabouts can you, if someone wants to watch these military flights zipping about around the world, what websites are there that you can use?
In particular, the civilian planes on contract are easier to track. We use a number of websites. There's one called flightradar24.com, and there's another one called flightaware.com. And you can track almost any plane that's flying, particularly Aer Lingus or British Airways, anywhere in the world, and any civilian plane even contracted US military.
But not the military ones,
The military ones are a little bit more difficult, but we have ways of tracking those as well. But clearly, being at the airport and seeing the military planes and taking photographs of them, and then we put the photographs up on the internet as well. So we have a website called Shannon Watch, www.shannonwatch.org, and we published up there, as well as on my own Facebook page.
Nowadays, they have some very big transport planes. You could probably not a brigade. You might be able to get a full battalion into one plane and fly it across the world and then just sort of drop them off.
In fact, that was happening today. In fact, there was one plane, an Omni Air is the name of the company. It carries about 300 armed US troops. That particular plane, I can even give you the number. Its tail number is N207AX. For the last several weeks, that plane has been flying from the States, landing at Shannon, refueling, going on to Kuwait, then going on to some other airport in the Middle East, like Qatar, some of the air bases. And the troops are then distributed from there in smaller planes, then flies back, refuels the Shannon airport. It's probably bringing back another 300 US troops who have finished their tour of duty and flies back to the States to some US airbase. So just today, that one, I actually photographed that plane and put it up on my own Facebook page. And that's fairly typical. And in any one day, there will be several either planes on contract with US military or actual military planes themselves.
Well, what do you make of the way the United States is behaving? They seem to be putting their military power all over the world, particularly into the Middle East ever since September the 11th.
Absolutely. In fact, they used September the 11th, which I have no doubt was an atrocity committed by Al-Qaeda, but they didn't use that to completely ignore international law. And it is a huge breach of international law, but it's not just the United States. We have the two other powers, Britain and France, who are part of NATO, but who are also permanent members of the UN Security Council with a veto. They are also grossly breaching international law by participating in the bombing of Syria, the bombing of Libya, the overthrow of the governments in Afghanistan and Iraq, all in breach of international laws. So the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, which includes both China and Russia, are above the United Nations. They're above international law, and they're breaking it on a daily basis and breaking the UN Charter.
Edward, one of the most serious things, of course, is this whole rendition program where prisoners were secretly kidnapped, basically shanghaied, and sent to illegal torture jails. I mean, have you ever had any photographs that you've taken that have actually led to evidence that this is specifically going on in specific cases, which has been able to be used in order to get the US and the Western powers to behave themselves and not to do these renditions?
We have, in fact, from our monitoring, we noticed on at least up to 10 occasions, CIA planes known to be on contract to the CIA or owned by the CIA came to Shannon Airport. We haven't pinned an actual prisoner to Shannon Airport because clearly the prisoners are usually bound and gagged and they don't know where they are. Nobody ever searches these planes, which we've been trying to do. But we know this on up to 10 occasions. Planes on their way to capture somebody, torture him and bring him to Guantanamo or Bagram had been refueled both ways to Shannon Airport. Actually, I would slightly disagree with you when you say this is the most serious crime they're committing. Clearly, torture is a hugely heinous crime. But killing somebody is even more serious. And now the US government, to a very large extent, because it's become too embarrassing to torture people, because if they survive, they'll tell the tale. They are now carrying out targeted assassinations almost on a daily basis. Obama, in fact, in particular, was the one who switched from torturing people, even though it hasn't fully stopped, to actually assassinating them, clearly against all international law and against all local laws.
So, and, I mean, as a military man, where do you think this is heading? It does look a little bit like the breakdown of international law, doesn't it, Edward?
I think it is the breakdown of international law. It isn't just that it looks like it. In fact, I actually did a PhD a number of years ago on the reform of the United Nations, and I reluctantly concluded, in fact, in my thesis, that the United Nations is beyond reform because of the veto and because it's been grossly abused by the five veto powers in particular. But of the five, the worst offenders, in fact, are the US, UK and France. Russia and China occasionally breach it, but not nearly as blatantly and as seriously as the others. In fact, Syria is a good example. In fact, the UK and the US in particular have been bombing, firing missiles illegally and trying to overthrow the Assad government in clear breach of the UN Charter. Russia and its military involvement in Syria is not in breach of the UN Charter because they are invited in by a UN member, the Syrian government. But yes, it's international law is being hugely abused, and but in particular by France, Britain, and the US.
Do you ever bump into more sort of ordinary plane spotters? And if so, what do they make of you're up to, Edward?
In fact, as it happened, I was speaking to two of them this morning out there. They tend to, I suppose, steer clear of us to some extent, but sometimes we have a quick chat. But they obviously have a different agenda. Sometimes we might get some help from them, and they would tell us if they have, if they know a plane is coming in or whatever. But they would treat us with a little bit of caution. Like we would, to them, be a little bit too radical in what we do.
Okay.
At the same time.
What about your website? Can you just remind us where that is again, please?
Yes, Shannon Murch. So www.shannonwatch.org. And I'm also involved with the Irish Peace and Neutrality Alliance, which is www.pana.ie.
And what about social media? What about social media?
Yes, we use social media in various ways, and I'm on Facebook, and you know, I have a fairly public Facebook page. I use that again almost on a daily basis to explain what's going on in Shannon Airport in particular. It's, we are, I suppose, Shannon Watch is a relatively small group of people, but we do, I suppose, credit ourselves with at least keeping Ireland formally out of NATO, and we also know that up to 75% of the Irish people are strongly in favour of Irish neutrality. And while some people will see neutrality or claim that it's a cowardly way of behaving, the reality is, in fact, that Irish troops overseas with the UN have lost 88 soldiers killed since we started UN peacekeeping in the 1960s. And per head of population, and we have a tiny army, that's a similar casualty rate, in fact, per head of population that would have been suffered by the British forces in all the wars in the meantime. So it's anything but, in our view, a cowardly way. We are prepared to sacrifice our soldiers in genuine peacekeeping operations, but we don't want to be dragged into a European army attacking Russia or attacking Iraq or Afghanistan in a completely unjustified way. And okay, it is mainly about resources as well. You know, it's the wars being fought have nothing to do with democracy. They are about stealing resources from the countries in the Middle East and Africa and elsewhere.
Okay, former Major in the Irish Army, Edward Horgan, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Johnny.
Must be some kind of way out of here. Say the joker to the thief. I'm David Bazanko and I'm interviewing Tony this time.
Makes a change day, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. We have a slight difference of opinion on Brexit. And we've got a few questions.
Okay.
So, Tony, you're pro-Brexit, aren't you?
Generally, yes. A reason is because I've seen over the last 40 years or so, the decline of Britain's industrial ability and also the lack of jobs in Britain since we joined the European Union. The basic reason for that is because our industrial policy has been controlled by Brussels, and things like Airbus, as you can see here in Bristol, are now not British companies. In other words, where the profits stay in Britain, the expertise stays in Britain, they're now foreign-owned. In this case, Airbus is based in Toulouse, and the decisions about what happens to jobs here in Bristol now are made abroad. And as far as I can see, the only way that this country can kind of get back on its feet again is to take back control of its industrial policy. There, for example, we've got cities now, I mean, mainly in the north. We're lucky here in the south because the problem with jobs isn't so great. But in the north of England, you've got entire cities, such as Sheffield, etc., who don't have hardly any industry at all. They were based on that industry. The industry is gone, and you've got hundreds of thousands of people scratching their heads, wondering what they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, but wasn't that due to Thatcherite economics, monetarism?
Well, of course, Thatcher was part of it, actually, yes. You know, the asset stripping of British industry. There's a fantastic series which documents all of this called The Mayfair Set by Adam Curtis, which was broadcast by the BBC, I think, in the mid-1990s, looking at people like Sir Keith Joseph, who were pioneering this policy of going into industries and asset stripping them. But the reason they were doing that was to make them easily saleable. So you have a company where the bits that don't make lots of profit get removed, and the bits that make all the big profits stay, and then you sell them abroad. And that's what they were doing in the Thatcher era.
Well, this has been my fear, is that in the post-Brexit collapse, that's exactly what you'll get, is more asset stripping.
what we've got left of our economy is going to be bought up by vulture capitalists.
Well, possibly. But there is also a possibility that the import tariffs will massively encourage the investment in Britain to actually make things here in Britain. So the idea is if you make it in Britain, it's going to be a lot cheaper to buy. So the demand for manufactured goods here in Britain will be up again. At least that's what I hope. But, yeah, you mentioned the word crisis there. And I think that there could easily be, particularly if there's a no-deal Brexit, a serious crisis, because this what's happening with Brexit is not just in the UK. There's a massive movement in France. There's an enormous movement in Italy, which is now the government, and in other countries too, particularly in Greece and Spain and Portugal. There are enormous movements in Hungary, actually in Germany too. And if you consider, I've included France and Germany, massive movements in those countries which are saying we've had enough of Brussels. The only thing is that Britain is the only country that's had a chance to vote on this. I think it would be fascinating to see what would happen if there were votes right across the European Union in all the different countries.
Do you think it could get the dominoes started?
The dominoes already started. And I mean, particularly looking at what's happening in Spain with the secession of Catalonia, that for holding a vote, we've got something like 12 Catalonian politicians are now on trial for sedition. So that's for holding a vote for secession, a referendum, because in Catalonia for many, many years has wanted to secede and the Spanish government is simply not allowing it. So the idea that this is in any way democratic is completely wrong. And actually what they've done in Catalonia and in Brussels, and particularly in Brussels, by getting very heated against the people who want Brexit, you know, for example, saying things like they're going to go to the guillotine, there's a special place in hell prepared for people who want Brexit.
That's just people getting hot-headed, isn't it?
Well, though? It is, but what it does is it shows, I think, that they don't know what to do, that this is a movement that they've become. The comparison, I think, is very good, which some have made with the Soviet Union, is this is an alliance, the European Union is an alliance which could easily fracture very, very quickly and return back to its own original nation member states. And that's exactly what happened in the Soviet Union in around 1990. And they had a particularly horrific crisis because they were punished by the international oligarchy in Russia. The IMF and the powerful financiers made the economy scream in Russia to such an extent that there were half the jobs in Moscow were lost almost overnight. The currency went down to worth virtually nothing. And people couldn't buy food. They couldn't get food in the cities. So luckily in Russia, they've got a different setup to us here in Britain. They have this dacha system where the dachas are in the countryside. Many of the people that live and work in the cities also have country retreats. I think it's because in Russia you don't get a long summer, so they have a very nice place to go for the summer in the countryside.
There's a lot more countryside.
Yeah. It's a vast, vast country in any way. And so what happened in 1990 was lots and lots of city dwellers went to join their families in the country, and they started, and at least they had something to eat because the country people were growing crops. And they contributed to the agriculture of the country during those difficult years in the early 1990s. But we don't have anything like that in Britain.
Well, they went through like period when there was little money. People went over to barter, didn't they, for a while?
They did, of course. That's right.
And wouldn't we be doing something like probably, that over here? I mean, if it really got that bad in Europe and the UK.
But I mean, my point here is I think the international financial system, in a way, has to punish Britain to send a signal, a very strong signal to Italy, Greece, Portugal, particularly France, actually, right on our doorstep. You've got these anti-Brussels protests, which are not just anti-Brussels, but they're saying, effectively, the euro has not worked in France. They're talking about returning to the franc, etc. So if Britain has a successful Brexit, these countries, basically that's it, the EU will be finished, and they've got to send a very strong message, the oligarchy, to Europe that this must not be allowed to happen again. And that's what bothers me, is you've got also now, we're on the brink of an enormous international financial collapse with hedge funds and derivative markets. Nothing has been done about that caused the financial crisis in 2008.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, They're going to be making a profit through shorting on the UK.
This is the problem with derivatives, is you can use them to bet on a crash. You can use them to bet on disaster. You can use them to bet on the markets going up, but you can also use them to bet on the markets going down and make a killing financially, literally. And so there is a temptation for the oligarchs, the super rich, to say, right, well, we can make a load of money if we just collapse the economy now.
Wasn't how Soros made his money on the UK economy?
That's interesting.
When we exited the
he did, yeah.
The ERM, wasn't
that's
it?
That's right, exactly. And he's one of the people who said, watch out, because the European Union could be just like the collapse of the Soviet Union. It could happen very, very quickly. I think also that there's a possibility of war. There's an enormous amount of press censorship going on. I mean, back in January 2012, the British broadcasting regulators, Ofcom, shut down Press TV. Press TV is one of the only international satellite channels that I'm on anymore. And it is really putting the opposite point of view to what the oligarchy want. And they are looking at the kind of, shall we say, the two sides of the big Middle Eastern conflict, which is Iran and Israel. What we're getting most of the time here is positive coverage of Israel. Anybody that is negative about Israel seems to be embroiled in some kind of anti-Semitism scandal or whatever. They're saying that if you criticize Israel, you must be anti-Semitic, which of course is nonsense. So the press censorship is enormous. The idea that since 2012 we've not been able to hear what the Persian Empire has got to say about Middle East peace, even though, of course, they've been instrumental, along with the Russians, in getting rid of ISIS. We've seen the Americans trying to take the credit for it, but actually it's the Syrian Arab Army, the Iranian Army, and the Russian Army that have beaten ISIS. And we're not getting any of that. We're not allowed to hear it, and we're not allowed to see it, which is worrying. Because if you go back to the Second World War, World War II propaganda was rife. It was Radio Luxembourg was broadcasting Hitler propaganda through Lord Haw-Haw to Britain. Right the way through the tail end, well, it was most of the way through Second World War, Lord Haw-Haw was this British lord, and you can still get recordings of him, broadcasting to Britain. The British authorities never censored it. They allowed this propaganda to carry on and on and on right the way through the war, because they knew that if they were to be trying to censor it, that would make people want to watch it more. What they did instead, very cleverly and sensibly, was to lampoon it, to send it up and to joke about it. And we're not doing that anymore. What we've decided is we're going to try and censor the entire view of the Iranians, which is worrying, because the real problem, I think, in the nub of the problem, is effectively a nihilistic view. Now, nihilism really means you'll say anything and do anything to get what you want. And looking at the Israeli position in the Middle East now, I don't believe that they're really adhering to the values of the Ten Commandments, Moses, etc. I mean, they're supposed to be good to their neighbours, etc. But they're not doing that at all in the Zionist. In fact, what they've done is they've just passed the nation-state law in Israel, which is an apartheid law against the Palestinian people who originally were there. So that is a serious problem. I think what's going on...
Doesn't Israel have a right to defend itself?
From who? Who is actually attacking the Israelis? The Israelis are corralling the Palestinians. And nihilism, they will do anything they can to get what they want. What that includes doing things like twisting religion. Now, we saw that, for example, in England with the Puritans in the English Civil War. They said they were Christians. They weren't. They were twisting the faith, and they ended up killing a lot of people, destroying churches, that sort of thing. And it's the same sort of thing we saw with ISIS, smashing up the old Muslim buildings in Syria, for example, in Palmyra and places like that. It's exactly what was happening here in Britain back in the 1640s in the Civil War.
Well, that's all caught up with the Reformation, though, as well, isn't it?
Well, it was, yeah. That's true, and the dissolution of the monasteries and this whole idea of faith. But all I'm saying is it's very easy to hijack a faith. You get a small bunch of fanatics and you say, oh, the real conflict here is between these faiths. We saw that in Northern Ireland. I mean, actually, it wasn't a conflict between Protestants and Catholics. It was much more of a conflict between the nationalist community, who want a united Ireland, and the unionist community, who want to be united with England. But it was characterised as a religious fight. Now, that's exactly what I think we're seeing in the Middle East between Muslim and Jewish, supposedly, actually, it's mainly being fueled by fanatical nihilists. If we can start to understand that, then we can see just how dangerous this post-Brexit crisis could be with a potential nuclear war. Israel is a nuclear-armed state, and they have actually talked about using brute force against the Iranians. So it could be an economic crisis and a military crisis all rolled into one, but it's not necessarily going to be caused by Brexit. It's as a result of angering the international oligarchy.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name's Olivia and I'm the director of Many Minds, which is a mental health and performance arts charity based in Bristol. So what we do is we run workshops and make performance with people who identify with experiences of mental illness.
Now, I was just reading today, literally, on social media. It wasn't in the national press. Maybe it should have been. But art forms and doing art, looking at art, performing arts actually makes you better, can make you feel a lot better. Is that something that you've experienced? It sounds like that's the sort of thing you're up to in Many Minds.
Absolutely. I think it has been in the national press, actually. I have seen some articles and I think it's starting to become a more recognised thing in terms of social prescribing.
Well, so maybe this latest survey will be in the national press tomorrow. But, I mean, you know, so how does that all work? How does performing help people's mental health?
Well, we bring people together and we facilitate a space where people feel comfortable and safe to express themselves. And what we're doing a lot of the time is encouraging people to take risks a lot of the time in the nature of getting together and making something.
But that's very difficult for somebody, particularly if they're mentally ill, to drop their defences and say, well, actually, you know, I could be a scoutmaster, or I could be a cook, I could be a washerwoman, you know, I could be something completely different. That actually is quite a difficult thing for a lot of people to do.
Absolutely. It's not necessarily easy, but what we do is we never put pressure on people to participate. People come into the room and participating for them on a certain day might be just watching. It might be kind of standing up and saying their name in a circle. So at the beginning of every session, we check in with each other, and some people find it very difficult to maintain eye contact when they first come to us, or to say their name. Once they kind of keep re-engaging in their own way, we find that people slowly start to kind of enjoy themselves. I mean, we work a lot with play. So we come into the room and it's not like, here's a script and you're going to learn this and be on stage and perform Shakespeare. It's not like that at all with us. Everything that we do is devised. There are no scripts. We play together and then we make and devise pieces of performance together.
When you say play, that sounds interesting. Like, you play games. Are we talking about sort of theatrical games where you've got to use your imagination to play it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, some of the games we play are very simple. We play things like Zip Zap Boing and Grandmother's Footsteps. And it's just a way of kind of bringing people together and
You better take us through those two games. How do they work?
So Zip Zap Boing is a game where you pass a sound and a movement around the circle, and there are different rules. So you get to pass it across, you have to zap. To pass it to the person next to you, you have to zip. And Boing switches direction. And it's just a way for people to sort of relax, actually, and start enjoying themselves and be able to feel comfortable in a space together.
So do you ever find people can't cope with that? They give it a go and then they just sort of crash out. They can't really manage it.
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of people that come, and on some days they can do a lot, and on other days they can't. And we just meet them where they are at on that particular day. Because sometimes you're well, and sometimes you're not well, and that's okay. And it's okay for people to bow out, and we positively applaud people that sort of say no and say, well, actually, this is not for me right now. And it might be for them the next week or the next activity. So it's really kind of down to the individual how much they participate. And we find that really works, because when they're ready to participate, they will, and they'll step up, and we see big changes in people.
What sort of changes?
Well, we see masses of increase in self-esteem and confidence, people being able to kind of express themselves, people being able to feel more comfortable with their own sort of mental health and be able to talk about it more in a group. We see all sorts of things. I mean, like I think I was describing a little bit about how people might come to us the first time. A lot of people have a lot of social anxiety, so they might come and not be able to look at other people, and by the end of it they're performing on stage telling some of their personal stories to a group of 100 strangers, which is you know, and that can happen in the space of 2 or 3 months of coming to our weekly sessions.
So do you do public performances then?
We do.
Okay. Where, when?
So we, the last performance we did was at the Wardrobe Theatre, which was a piece devised by young people who had experienced homelessness and mental ill health. And so 16 to 25 year olds, and they performed a piece based on their own personal stories. We've also performed outdoors. We performed at Bristol Harbour Festival, a kind of walking performance, leading people through different parts of the city. We've performed at We the Curious, at the time it was at Bristol, the Watershed. We've performed in lots of different venues and also public spaces.
What brings somebody to that mental health state? I mean, your experience, what are the sorts of events in their life, or does sometimes it just happen to people out of the blue?
Absolutely. I mean, it can be anything. That's the thing with mental health, mental illness, is that it can affect anyone. We work with a lot of people that have experienced trauma, and that might be as a child or it might be as an adult. And then also just people that have been diagnosed with mental illness through, you know, through any point in their life. And they can have, everybody comes to us with a different story. And it's not something that we ask people to explain. People come, and the idea is that we're creating together, and we're not trying to find out about what their stories are. Sometimes they come out in the performances, but there's no obligation to tell us what their mental illness is.
The film I, Daniel Blake was on over the holiday, and it's pretty shocking, having seen it in the cinema, now on the TV too. And it was interesting the way that the government announced that it was going to suspend the implementation of the benefit system, universal credit, that same weekend it was on, which I wonder whether that was a coincidence or not. But it was pretty clear from that it was almost like an abusive relationship that some claimants, some people who are really down on their luck for whatever reason, have with the system. And I wonder, do you find anybody comes to you after that sort of experience?
We do. And we have actually made a piece that involved universal credit from young people's perspectives and experiences of the benefit system. And especially, I mean, we were looking at those issues because they are so important to people that we work with, and because a lot of people, for one reason or another, end up on benefits. And it's a complex system that people have to kind of navigate. And especially when they're not very well, can be very, very difficult, the things that they come up against. So for us, it's quite important to be able to channel that, some of that, into art, as I, Daniel Blake, does very, very well. I think that that's really important for people to be able to have a voice, and arts and performance is a way for people to have a voice on those issues that are really difficult, and often people don't really get the chance to kind of channel and have a voice in that spectrum when talking politically.
Well, it's great for them to have a voice, but they also need a roof over their head, and they need something to eat as well.
Indeed, yeah.
So, I mean, you know, you must come across some people like that who are saying, well, it's all very well doing all this therapy, but actually I just need a roof over my head, please.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. We need to work together. We have people that, you know, we worked with a group of young people that have experienced homelessness, and some people that are on the streets at that particular point might not be necessarily thinking, right, I'm going to engage in a weekly workshop. However, some people do, because that might be all they have, and that might be their 3 hours of a week where they've got somewhere warm to go.
The amazing thing is, and you must come across this dealing with mental health, is some people will cope with exactly the same dreadful situation. Some people can cope, other people can't. What's the difference?
Well, I mean, I think
it's a difficult question.
What's the difference between everyone and us all as individuals? We're all complex human beings.
We're also joined by Vicky Brown, who's also part of Many Minds. Vicky, what's your role?
I am the artistic director of Many Minds, and that kind of means that I lead sort of on the directing of most of the performances that we do. Actually, that's not always true, but I kind of oversee the artistic vision for the organisation. I'm a performance artist outside of my work at Many Minds, and I make my own performance work. So I really bring that to the charity.
So what's your background?
So I'm a performance artist, which means I make solo performance for theatre spaces generally, but I've worked in all sorts of other contexts.
So it doesn't sound quite like you're saying I'm an actress. You do something slightly different to what an actress would do. What's that?
Yeah, absolutely. Difference? So I come up with the concepts for performance. So I've worked as a director in a more kind of traditional performance context where there's like an actor and a director and a writer and the rest of that. But my real strength is coming up with sort of the overall concepts for the performance. And in my work that I make on my own, it's also sort of based in autobiography. And then I'm kind of going from there, and I'm the lead artist, so I'll come up with the concepts for the lighting, for the design, I'll write the text. I kind of do a bit of everything. And the key thing is that I'm always being myself. I'm never playing anyone else.
So you're not an actress?
No, because I'm just being Vicky on stage. And I think that's something that I bring to my work with Many Minds very strongly, in the sense that our work sits within a kind of contemporary performance field, because we're inviting people to explore their sense of self and their own identity. And, you know, when they've G'd themselves up to get the confidence to go on stage, it's really theirs. It doesn't belong to a character that they've fabricated or made up. Or sometimes it does, depending on the work that we're making. But they can really take ownership of their sort of personal triumph in managing to get up there.
But surely drama, a lot of drama is about escapism. You're getting away from, you're going into any other world rather than where you really are.
Mm, and there's a great, great value in that. We do some work within a forum theatre sort of structure, which is where we do work with characters. So we kind of have multiple, you know, strands of our work. And that's one of them where we work with young people who've experienced homelessness, and they're able to use their personal experiences to build stories and narrative of characters.
Now, what about comic or serious? Tragedy, comedy, whereabouts are you on that spectrum there?
Well, my work has been described as darkly comic, which means that I deal with really difficult topics. So Olivia actually met me by seeing one of my performances was about my experience of anxiety and depression. And the next piece I made was about death, the death of my grandmother. And I'm now making a work that I thought was about drag, but probably is veering towards being more about sort of sexual assault and the Me Too movement. So I make work about really meaty topics, but often the work is full of glitter cannons and loads of music and dancing and interaction. It's very, like, highly entertaining. It's fun. There'll be lots of laughter. So using this sort of entertainment angle, I find it really useful as a way to deal with topics. And I think, again, that's something I really bring to the work with Many Minds, and we're dealing with difficult stuff, but we are going about it with a humour and acceptance and of it that makes it easy to talk about.
Sounds good. Olivia, what about you on the tragedy comedy scale?
Well, I mean, my role in the room is generally to support Vicky and support our participants, because a lot of this work, as Vicky said, is very, it's very difficult topics, but we're trying to kind of deal with it in quite a light way. But it does bring stuff up for a lot of people, and we need to be able to kind of support that. So a lot of my role is to do that, and I think I bring a little bit of humour to that as well. But I definitely think that dealing with difficult topics is really important in artwork and in our work at Many Minds, but also to be able to laugh together, to play together, and to do all of those things is really important as well. So I think humour is a really important way of us being able to kind of hold and make pieces that are really impactful for the public as well as our members.
So Vicky, what about games? We were hearing a little bit earlier from Olivia about games. Can you just tell us those? I think this is some of the things I can remember about drama, watching it. I suppose we're talking about more than 10, 15 years ago on TV, there were quite a lot of programmes that would deal with these kind of drama games where you get actors and actresses on stage improvising in these sort of games. So can you tell us what sort of games you play at Many Minds?
Oh, well, we play a lot of games. I mean, it's one of my aims within the first kind of like 10 minutes of any session. I want everyone... I try and allow for laughter to be present in the space. It feels a really important way of everyone becoming comfortable, opening up a little bit, because you can only get to the kind of the hard topics if you're a little bit open and if you feel connected and supported by the people around you. So we do lots of games that allow for some of that.
So a lot of it sounds like, it, Olivia, it's about confidence. How do people get actually referred to you, or do people just turn up?
Well, people can just turn up. We promote our services on our website, and we actually go and work with a lot of organisations and mental health organisations and the NHS to promote what we do. But it's totally open access. So we do weekly workshops. We're going to start the next series in February. We're not sure on the venue yet, but we will be promoting it quite soon all over our social media. We do find a lot of people find out about us through word of mouth, actually. So we're only a year old as a charity. So we've been going for a year, and people keep walking through the doors, and we keep getting more and more people wanting to be involved in the sessions. So if anyone's listening and they want to be involved, they can get in contact with us or just pop along to any of our sessions. And when you first come in, we have people that greet you, some of our members, and me and Vicky will always be there. And we do, you know, we've got a small membership form that you'd fill out when you're there, but you just turn up, basically. And we find that's a very effective way of getting people through the doors.
So how are you funded? Is it through health service funding, local authority, government, you know, charity, fundraising, that sort of thing?
Some of those.
Bit of everything.
We have, I mean, last year we did a hell of a lot of... cycle rides, runs. We did a lot of charity fundraising. We had some individual donations, a lot of events. We also got a little bits of funding. We got some bits from the Bristol City Council Arts Fund, a tiny pot. So we get pots from different places. We had some big lottery money. And our next project, which is a big project, we got some money from the Arts Council. So the Arts Council England gave us some money for our next big project.
Which is,
I'll hand over to Vicky, because okay. It's sort of Vicky's big project that she's going to be directing.
Yeah, so it's an outside walking performance. I mean, obviously, we've done a little bit of working on this already, and we're going to be working on it from February to May. So it could all totally change. But at the moment, we think it's an outside walking performance led by our members that leads the audience round the city, showing them sort of the experience of the city through their eyes, stopping to see something, noticing it, walking over to a tree where maybe up it there's a performance, experiencing public space in a very different way and disrupting that public space by moving a group of people through it. And it's a really important opportunity for us politically as well to put people with experience of mental ill health in the driving seat, leading a group of people, showing them where they should be and what they should do in a public space in order to sort of shift people's perceptions.
Online is probably quite easy. You can give me a website or something. Whereabouts do people find you?
Oh, we do workshops in different places, so it's good to kind of connect in with us to find out a bit more, either from our website. We're also on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. But we're not sure yet where our next set of workshops will be. We've done them in Stokes Croft, we've done them in Bedminster. We don't actually have like a set place where we do them. We're kind of quite mobile. Our next project, this outdoor walking project, we want to be engaging with people from different ethnicities as well, so BAME groups. So we're potentially looking at places that might be kind of easy to access for those groups as well. And we're going to be doing a set of potentially free workshops for groups that that want to find out a little bit more about us. So if you're working with BAME groups and you want to find out and want a free workshop in your space, we're really willing to come to you to do a little mini workshop to bring people into the project.
And our website is www.manyminds.org.
Many-minds.org.
Many-minds.
Okay. Many-minds.
Okay.
And well done, Olivia. That's why she's the one driving the ship.
And phone number, Olivia?
Phone number is 07843-210272.
So Olivia Ware and Vicky Brown from Many Minds, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Major Edward Horgan in Ireland, and also Olivia Ware and Vicky Brown from Many Minds. Also to studio engineers Dave Bazanko and Joss Chivers. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. If you have some spare time, you can volunteer with us over hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
Intolerance and racial intolerance.